I wasn't going to drink any coffee today, and here I am. We'll call the meeting to order. Good morning. It is Wednesday, September 7th, 2011. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission, and we're here in the North Dakota Public Service Commission hearing room in the 12th floor of the state capitol. For the record, this is Tony Clark, Commission Chairman. I'd like to welcome everyone here today. Are there any opening comments from my fellow commissioners?
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning and welcome as well.
Very good. Congratulations go out to Rich Wardner, who was elected Senate Majority Leader last night. Rich had the pleasure of serving with in the House, in fact, sat next to for a couple of sessions. Before he moved over to the Senate, he probably understands as much, if not more, about energy than just about anyone else down there, and certainly the work of this commission, having served as chair of the Interim Energy Committee over the last few sessions. So congratulations to Rich. I know he'll make a great leader for the state Senate. With that, there are some items on the consent agenda.
I move passage of items in the consent.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Moving to items in my portfolio, TC1. I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order issuing certificate of corridor compatibility for transmission facility number 121 to Minn Kota Power Co-op, Inc., for its proposed 345 kV electric transmission line from Center to Grand Forks, North Dakota, case number PU-09-670.
Second.
It pays to remember in this case that this is the corridor designation, not a route permit as well. And in many cases, when we're handling transmission lines, we have a consolidated route and corridor application. In this case, as much as anything, because the route is so long, or the proposed transmission line is so long, it's been handled in two separate stages. So this is the corridor that we're citing today, and then within this corridor at a later date, there'll be a cited route, which is the actual physical location of the line itself. This is a substantial line. It's a 345 kV line, which is on the larger side of transmission lines that we've cited in North Dakota. It's a project which is designed to connect the Milton R. Young Unit 2 station with Minn Kota's system in the northeast part of the state. This is part of the project that we've discussed at length from time to time, which involves Minnesota Power turning over its portion of the Milton R. Young Unit 2 generating station to Minn Kota, Minn Kota taking that power, and then the existing DC line, which connects the Milton R. Young station, being converted to basically a wind line that Minnesota Power is using to deliver power to its service territory in northeast Minnesota. This particular project is wholly contained within North Dakota. It contains approximately 247 miles of new high-voltage AC line. And as I said, it connects from Milton R. Young near Center to near Grand Forks, the Prairie substation near Grand Forks. As far as how this particular line will look, the majority of the project will be constructed using single-pole, self-supporting, self-weathering steel, single-circuit structures placed on drilled pier foundations. So the look is actually a little different than some of the other high-voltage transmission lines that you may see across the state that were utilized in construction during an earlier era. They're moving to primarily a single-pole construction. The typical structures will stand in height approximately 95 to 180 feet, and the typical span between structures is going to be 1,000 feet. The construction of the proposed project is expected to begin in the fall of 2011, if everything stays on track. But again, that will only be after an actual route proceeding is handled. And it's Minn Kota hopes to complete that by mid the project itself, to be in service by the third quarter of 2013. So it's a fairly lengthy construction project as well. With any project of this length, you're going to have some exclusion and avoidance areas within the corridor. There is one exclusion area in the corridor, which relates to the crossing the Missouri River and the Piping Plover. However, any of that habitat will be avoided during construction. In addition, there are a number of avoidance areas, and in each of them there are going to be attempts made in the actual routing of the line itself to avoid those avoidance areas. The perhaps one of the more unique features of this route that received some attention from the commission, and we received it, and we conducted three hearings in this particular case so that we made it fairly easy for anyone who wished to testify to get to one of those hearings. And they were lengthy hearings, in some cases extending into the evening, which is fine. That's why we hold them. The one of the more unique aspects of public testimony that was presented by representatives of Audubon, Dakota, and the Grand Forks County Prairie Partners, which had concerns about the transmission line through an area of saline prairie, which is known as the Alkaline Flats in central and western Grand Forks County. One of the challenges that the commission had with this, and I was one who wanted to look very carefully at this, is that unfortunately for the case of those who wanted to avoid that particular area, there's nothing that designates this as an area that's to be avoided, not in statute, not in rules. It doesn't have any special designation from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or anything like that. So really, as far as any legal standing, there wasn't anything there. The problem with avoiding that particular area was that if that area is to be avoided, then you were moving the line into areas that did have some sort of protection in statute of the rule. In other words, you were putting it much closer to homes, which are something which is recognized in the rules. You were having much greater impact on tillable agricultural land, which is something that the commission is to look at. So the other thing that tipped it in favor of basically using the route that was, or the corridor that was proposed by Minn Kota, is that they're going to be paralleling an existing line. So to the degree that there is a line there already, I think it's helpful that they're going to be using that particular corridor. In addition, the commission is recognizing in here and encouraging Minn Kota to consult with both Audubon and the Grand Forks County Prairie Partners so that in construction of the project, it's done in a way that minimizes impact. Attached to the order, which you should have in front of you, are a series of maps, and it basically covers the entire project line. The one of the things that I should note is that in a number of instances, because of public testimony that we received, the commission did encourage Minn Kota to revise its application, and so there are a number of spots on the maps that you'll notice where the corridor itself is actually wider than it was as originally proposed. They proposed a 1,000-foot corridor. That was something that the commission was all right with in this case because, as you know, a very large corridor, if it was permitted, would allow future development through a very large swath of North Dakota with minimal oversight given the status of current law. Yet there were portions of the line that we requested that they extend the corridor because we wanted to have additional flexibility when it came to the actual route siting. And these were in direct relation to landowner concerns that we received at the hearings, which is why we hold the hearings, which is why we encourage people to testify. Usually it involved things, for example, landowners saying, look, I don't, it's all right if it's on my land, but I need it on the other side of the property here because of X, Y, and Z factors. Or could you put it on this other side of the hill so it's not such a, I don't have to drive under it every morning on my way out of the farmstead. Things like that. And those are the sorts of issues that we want to be able to address in a route siting. And so you'll notice that there are a number of places on the map where the corridor has been widened.
You know, the one thing I would add to that, a siting of this magnitude in a project this large involves obviously a lot of preparation by the company and a lot of involvement by landowners. And I think that of all of more difficult siting cases I've been part of, I was quite impressed with the company's preparation for this one, because to have three hearings as long as we had them with as much participation as we had, and to have the level of landowner participation, and it was all very respectful participation, I think that the order reflects the some of the more reasonable suggestions by landowners and thoughtful people And this, I'd have to say that the process that is established for us to site these types of infrastructures really worked extremely well in this case. And you know, hanging out in Washburn till 10 o'clock on a Friday night was really not all that bad. And so I really appreciated the landowner input. And I hope that, and I've talked to some landowners, are quite encouraged by that process, that they came, they were heard. And there were some things we can't do anything about, some things are outside of our jurisdiction, but the things that were within our jurisdiction and that were reasonable, we were able to accommodate. And I say we, I include the company as well as the commission in that. So good work to everyone who did. Now we have the hard work ahead of us of micro-siting the route.
The only thing I wanted to add is that to extend the landowner concerns, initially this was scheduled for May 3rd, 4th, and 13th. We had landowners come in and asked us to move that to June. So then we moved it to the dates of June 16, 17, and 24. But from the very beginning, I think the process that the commission has laid out over the years really worked in this one. And as they pointed out, it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. But very good proceeding so far.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
TC2, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-11-549, canceling warehouse license numbers 1161 and 1231, respectively issued to Technology Crops, Inc., Winston-Salem, North Carolina, at Wimbledon and Pingree, North Dakota, and ordering that business at Wimbledon and Pingree is discontinued effective immediately.
Second.
This is not quite as dramatic as it sounds. TCI is apparently just reorganized from an Inc. to an LLC, so they're updating their paperwork.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-11-547, granting the request of Technology Crops LLC, doing business at Technology Crops International, to operate an 878,000-bushel grain warehouse at Wimbledon, North Dakota, and a 916,000-bushel grain warehouse at Pingree, North Dakota, effective immediately.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC4, I move the commission issue a notice of consolidated hearing in Montana Dakota Utility Company's application for advanced determination of prudence for Big Stone Generating Plant Air Quality Control Equipment, case number PU-11-163, and Otter Tail Power Company's application for advanced determination of prudence for Big Stone Generating Plant Air Quality Control Equipment, case number PU-11-165, under North Dakota Administrative Code section 69-02-04-04. The hearings in these cases are scheduled for November 29th. I think we set aside 2 days, so if we need the second day on the 30th, we have it. But to begin on November 29th here in the commission meeting room in the state capitol, 12th floor, at 8:30 a.m.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC5, I move the commission issue a notice of filing a notice of intervention deadline in Montana Dakota Utility Company's application for advanced determination of prudence for its investment in an 88-megawatt simple cycle combustion turbine to be located adjacent to MDU's Heskett Generating Station near Mandan, North Dakota, case number PU-11-395, and in Montana Dakota Utility Company's application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity for the same 88-megawatt simple-cycle combustion turbine, case number PU-11-396.
Second.
Just a notice of filing and notice of intervention deadline. The petition to intervene for anyone wishing to become a party to these proceedings must be filed by October 14th of 2011.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio. Commissioner Kalk.
Good morning. Item BK1. I move the commission adopt the order approving electric service area agreement in the joint application of Montana Dakota Utility Company and Montreal Williams Electric Cooperative for approval of a service area agreement and the resulting issuance of a certificate of public convenience and necessity to establish locations and designate service locations to be served by MDU and Montreal Williams within and around the city of Williston, North Dakota. Case numbers PU-11344 and PU-11374.
Second.
Basically, in June of this year, MDU and Montreal Williams filed a joint application for approval of a service area agreement to establish areas and designate service locations to be served by MDU and Montreal Williams within and around the city of Williston. As you can imagine, the growth up there really necessitated this discussion. On July 13th, the commission issued a notice of filing, notice of informal hearing, and notice of opportunity for hearing, which provided until August 23rd for those interested to provide comments. No comments were received. On August 24th, this commission had an informal hearing. We talked about the contents of the agreement, had a lot of discussion about it, and basically the goal here was to make sure that we avoid misunderstanding and disagreement within service areas. We accomplished the legislative intent laid out under Century Code to promote safety, harmony, and operational efficiency in these areas, and provide both parties with the equitable participation in the provision of electric services within the city of Williston. What really was interesting was that both companies, when they came in the informal, were very excited to have this discussion because you can imagine the growth up there. Montreal Williams has more work than they've ever planned on, and MDU just wants to make sure that they know what the future is going to look like. So there's an enclosed map that lays out that the city limits. Basically, MDU is going to pick up more service area to the west and a little bit to the east and the southeast, and then Montreal Williams will then, of course, plan their build-out accordingly for future customers in that area. But I would really encourage other investor-owned utilities and cities to do this type of thing because I think it really sets the stage for future growth and really does a good job.
What was amazing to me is the contrast of how well this law has worked over the last, maybe 5 years since it's been passed, in comparison to how contentious territorial integrity issues had been for so many years. I think this has been a very good law, and to see in this case in particular how well it worked, when you get down to the operational folks within these communities, the rural electric cooperatives and the investor-owned utility cooperative, the engineers, the linemen, these folks who actually keep the lights on work very closely together, and they work very well together. And you saw that in this particular informal, and I compliment both companies on coming to a resolution which is mutually beneficial for them, but most importantly, for the purpose of this commission, beneficial for the customers of both of those utilities. It ensures that there's going to be an orderly grid that develops in the area in and around Williston.
There's nothing like more business than one company can handle to force harmony and cooperation. But having said that, I would echo Tony's comments. I mean, Dale Haugen, as the general manager of Montreal Williams, and Ken Callahan, the regional manager for MDU, clearly have a partnership, a personal partnership, in addition to the corporate partnership that meets this incredible growing demand, which provides both, of course, opportunities for the power providers as well as tremendous challenges. And I would have to say, having listened to them during the informal, that there was more than just harmony. There was real synergy that was gained by having two companies with different resources and all of that talent workforce and expertise working together to meet this growing demand. And as we know, the demand in the Bakken and Williston as its hub isn't just simply a nice slow growth demand. This is a very urgent demand. So the priorities, of course, of Montreal Williams are to meet those instant almost requirements to get the oil discovered and recovered, and the demands of Montreal or of MDU and, of course, the entire city of Williston is to be that service center. And that means more than just electricity for oil wells, but it means all of the utilities, water, gas, electricity, roads, all of that infrastructure that supports the services that support the industry. So it was a rich reward. This is our 13th service area agreement since the law was passed, and I would have to say this one is unique among the 13.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Item BK2. I move the commission adopt the order certifying use of federal universal service support for new singular wireless PCS LLC to receive Federal Universal Services funding for the period beginning July 13, 2011 through December 31, 2011, case number PU10476.
Second.
On March of this year, New Singular filed with the North Dakota Public Service Commission an application to be designated as an eligible carrier for the purpose of receiving Federal Universal Services support. On July 13th, the commission designated New Singular Wireless as an eligible carrier. Also on that March 23rd filing, New Singular Wireless included affidavit of Hardman Williams, the vice president, that the money received would only be used for provisions, maintenance, and upgrading of the facilities and services for which the support is intended. One of the requirements is within 60 days of that order that we do this appropriate order certifying the use, so then they can this can be filed with Universal Service Administrative Company and the FCC. So that necessitates this order today. I think it's actually next meeting we'll have those for all the companies certifying for 2012.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
And that concludes the items in my portfolio.
Thank you. Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. KC1. I move the Commission issue a notice of continued hearing in the request of Bakken Link Pipeline, LLC, for a waiver of procedures and time schedules for a corridor certificate and a route permit for the construction of approximately 144 miles of crude oil pipeline in Billings-Dunn, McKenzie, Stark, and Williams Counties, North Dakota, case number PU-10218.
Second.
If this sounds familiar, it ought to. It was just 1 month ago that the Commission issued a notice of filing and a notice of hearing that was scheduled to begin September 1st for this pipeline project, but at a work session on August 30th, we indefinitely continued the formal hearing that was scheduled for September 1st in Watford City. The purpose for continuing the hearing was a request by the company, basically just being prepared. We could have had the hearing on September 1st, heard some of the testimony and evidence, continued it, but the company was not prepared to provide the whole case. Looking at calendars and schedules, it just seemed a lot more prudent to continue the hearing from here and then reschedule the hearing for October 25th, 2011, at 9 a.m. in the McKenzie County Courthouse in Watford City. So this is the Bakken Link, the 144 miles that would carry Bakken crude through the counties listed in the motion down to the rail facility being proposed near Belfield.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. KC2. I move the Commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order issuing Certificate of Corridor Compatibility Number 122 and Route Permit Number 131 to Bear Paw Energy, LLC, for the construction of a 10-inch pipeline in McKenzie County, North Dakota, for the transmission of natural gas liquids, case number PU-1166.
Second.
You may recall that the Commission previously cited the Bear Paw, one of three recent Bear Paw gas processing facilities, this one being the Garden Creek facility near Watford City. That facility is getting closer to completion and getting ready to go online, but there is a need for moving not only the natural gas, but the natural gas liquids. This pipeline would take those natural gas liquids through the remainder of McKenzie County into Richland County, Montana, where they have a terminal and a rail facility to take those liquids into the marketplace. We had the hearing in Watford City on the application. Everything went well. There was no opposition. Things went rather smoothly. Part of this line does actually enjoy an existing corridor as well, especially through federal lands or Forest Service lands. The natural gas liquids are an important component of course, natural gas processing. They are, in some respects, the other products, things like ethane, pentane, propane, butane, I always call them the Tane brothers, that have a place in the market, but they have no place in the environment. So in terms of waste, they're hard to get rid of. Interesting about this, and as I understand it, this would be about 65,000 barrels per day of liquid capacity on the line. It's intention of the company to go into construction pretty much immediately and have it completed this fall. It's a roughly 64 mile, I think, in total line. 54 of the miles are in North Dakota. The other 10 are, of course, in Montana. To put it into some perspective, and we always like to put pipelines in perspective, especially as it relates to trucks, this would require 55 trucks every day to move this these natural gas liquids to the same location. So, you know, 55 trucks a day forever, or at least for a number of years and decades, is a considerable amount of traffic taken off of the roads. The residue gas, of course, and the ethane from the facility itself will go to the Northern Border Pipeline via WBI. They're in very close proximity already to existing export capacity for the natural gas itself. So this was a, Dave, $24 million price tag on this investment. And as I said, construction is preparing. They're probably starting up the engines right now out there in the prairie.
The only thing I would add to this project is prior to the hearing, this goes through some of the grasslands, and I thought there might be some issues to come up on that. And really, the company did a very good job working with the Forest Service, and there's always some established infrastructure in that area, I think, that really made this project move along quicker than I thought it could have at the hearing, quite honestly. And I think that as we look at some of our future projects that go through the Forest Service land, it'll be interesting to see how those all play out. But in this case, it went very, very well.
It did, and having that existing line there was very helpful. You do hear horror stories from time to time about trying to cross federal lands, especially in the western part of the country. But my compliments to the Forest Service and to the company for working through those issues, utilizing existing pipeline that was there to minimize some of those. Trying to connect this facility to where they wanted it to go in Sydney without going through federal land would have been very, very difficult, if not prohibitive.
All in favor?
Aye.
And KC3. I move the commission deem the applications complete and issue a notice of filings and notice of hearing in the request of Plains Pipeline LP for waiver of procedures and time schedules for a corridor certificate and for a route permit for the construction of approximately 31.8 miles of 12-inch crude oil pipeline from its Trenton station to the North Dakota-Montana boundary, all in Williams County, North Dakota, case number PU 10630.
Second.
The public hearing on this pipeline is scheduled to begin November 1st, 2011 at 10 a.m. Central Daylight Time at the City Hall in Williston, North Dakota. Again, this project's one that's been around a little bit and been in and out of our doc, not in and out of our doc, but in and out of our consciousness probably, but it is time to move forward with it. It is a 12.75-inch outside diameter steel pipeline that's being proposed. It would be, in total, a 79-mile pipeline with about, as I said, in the motion, 31.8 miles of it to be located in Williams County, North Dakota. It will originate at the Plains Trenton Station, which is located about 9.5 miles from Williston, and then moves generally north and west to a point about 2.5 miles north of Outlook in Sheridan County, Montana. From there, Plains already owns what's called the Wascana Pipeline, and that would transport the crude oil to Regina, Saskatchewan. Once it's in Regina, when it gets to Regina, there's a little bit of infrastructure up there. It has the opportunity to jump onto at least two third-party transmission carriers, one being the TransCanada Keystone line, the other being Enbridge line in that area. And Plains has really established itself as a midstream transmission company, and this is just getting it to those big pipes to get it to a bigger market.
All in favor?
Aye.
And that ends items in my portfolio.
Very good. I left my agenda back in the office.
Feel free.
Thank you very much. That ends the items that are on the regular agenda today. We do, of course, have an administrative agenda coming up here shortly after this meeting recesses, and then we have an informal this afternoon to discuss one item, which is the MDU. Take a look at it. This is our informal today. What's that? Oh, that's right. It's the White Earth case. The retirement case.
And Phyllis Richter's retirement following.
Phyllis Richter's retirement this afternoon following that, her party. So we'll welcome folks to that. With regard to upcoming meetings, our next meeting is actually a little bit off schedule. We'll be doing it September 20th, which is a Tuesday at 10 a.m., not our regular Wednesday. So 13 days from now. And we do have a few other issues to deal with prior to that. On Thursday, September 15th, we will be in Center, back at the Oliver County Courthouse, where we've been a few times, to have a formal hearing at 10 a.m. on Elite Inc.'s Bison 3 Wind Project siting application. Again, a project in an area of the state we've become very familiar with. on Tuesday, or and that's our only formal hearing before our next meeting. With that, if there's nothing else, we will turn to questions.
I just wanted to reconfirm these couple of these hearing dates. On KC3, the hearing is November 1st at 10 a.m. the City Hall in Williston.
That's correct.
Okay, and the Bakken Link hearing is October 25th at 9 a.m. at the McKenzie County Courthouse in Watford City.
And that is correct.
And also TC4, the hearings on November 29th and possibly the 30th here, beginning at 8:30 a.m.
8:30 the 29th, right.
Right.
Okay. Can you explain to me why the territorial agreement between Montrell Williams and MDU, I mean, I can see how this benefits the companies, but how does it benefit consumers?
Well, I think the biggest thing that would benefit consumers is they know where to go to look for their electricity. I mean, if you're going to move somewhere, they're going to be able to not have to go to have everyone be determined by, well, should we request MDU service, should we request Montrell Williams? People that are developing those parts of the city will know exactly where to go to set up their agreements.
The term we often use as we deal through these territorial integrity issues is we try to avoid checkerboarding, where we don't want utility systems building out duplicative networks, investing more than they need to in distribution lines, creating really from an engineering standpoint a very inefficient network, and from a cost standpoint an inefficient network. And so what this does is it creates very rational, fairly large geographic blocks of land that'll provide certainty for the companies and customers, but also will allow it to be rolled out in a very economical fashion, as opposed to having this sort of checkerboard of utility companies serving a similar area.
Well, the service area agreement law put a great deal of weight on harmony. It did not dispose of the fundamental law, which is, of course, to avoid wasteful duplication. So these service area agreements still have to meet that basic standard. The other thing I might add with regard to this particular situation is that, and the question was asked and answered very well, and that is that rates between these two companies are pretty much on par. So you don't have a great rate disparity that causes, a great deal of concern by one consumer versus another consumer or neighbor to a neighbor. And that certainly makes it a lot easier.
Is that, there have been other agreements where that isn't true amongst the two utilities, how in terms of being rate similar, having similar rates, to what extent did that make it easier to do this particular?
That was one of the first questions that I asked, was what's the difference in rates? I think that makes it a lot easier for the two companies to work together as well. I think that's the big thing, is that I'm sure they each have people that potentially have a vested interest, and the fact that the rates are similar makes a big difference for the consumers that are affected by this decision.
Do you think that by avoiding this checkerboarding that it does result in lower rates, however lower they might be?
Sure it would. I would be less. If you don't have duplication of services, people aren't paying for things twice. I mean, it's about that easy.
And how long has that agreement been in the works?
Boy, that one, I don't know that question came up, but I would...
Well, it sounded like it came together pretty fast. So, I mean, it was not an extensive negotiation from what they...
You know whose idea it was?
Who approached who first?
I don't know.
It's interesting. One of the most significant things I heard at the hearing was that the power Montrell Williams is going to need to have. So I almost got the feeling that Montrell Williams just has more going on right now than they're interested.
Well, they got more business than they can handle, right?
Exactly. And then so they probably necessity.
Although it was interesting to hear, the MDU's got a fair amount of business. I mean, we hear about Montrell Williams a lot because I think they're picking up a large portion of what's going on in the Bakken. But both companies indicated that there are plenty of times when there's some sort of service that needs to be extended. MDU is closer, and so MDU picks up that load. And, in fact, for that backbone network, the larger than just distribution lines, very much they're depending on each other as this energy development takes place. And so I think that that's fostered probably a lot of the collegiality that both companies have in that particular area, which is that they're both in this together and they depend on each other quite a bit to ensure the lights stay on.
Do you know how big the yellow area is to the west in terms of the territory that that the MDU is going to be serving.
Each one of those should be a square
outside
mile.
Outside the city?
That's what I would say. Each one is a square mile, so you could figure that out.
Okay.
One of the things that also I thought was that we asked about workers. They're going to be growing anywhere from 30 to 50 additional workers for both companies in this area. So it's everything up there is really hitting full stride.
What is the number of – what does the adding of the employment have to do with this? Does that have anything to do with it?
Well, just that there's going to be so much growth that they designate the service area, then all of a sudden there's going to be things that are built there quickly. It's not like this is just going to be on the board somewhere. I got the impression that as soon as they've laid out this agreement, people are going to start building condominiums or homes or whatever it might be, and they're going to need workers to do that work very quickly to meet the growth in this region.
Why was it necessary to designate this area here, the one to the north?
That's their current headquarters, I believe, so they just wanted to make sure that that was laid out in case some point down
Montreal
the road.
Montreal Williams' headquarters.
Yeah, I was just wondering why, I mean, did MDU ever say that, gee, we'd like to serve this particular block way out of town?
I don't know.
I doubt that. But there's areas in the southwestern part of that map, Dale, you look at that are also that may have been yellow, if you will. When you look at it, that's also existing Montreal Williams. So I think a lot of it was they wanted to make sure their current infrastructure is theirs and that will ever come up for future debate.
Do you have a list of the 13 agreements?
Sure, that we could do. Be easy to.
Okay,
yeah.
I'd appreciate that.
If Kara's listening, she could start that right now.
Can you explain to me the importance of the alkaline flats? I mean, why?
Depends on who you talk to.
Yeah,
I mean, why was it that
the issue that was raised by
that you mentioned
by Audubon and Grand Forks Partners? The issue that they raise is that they believe that it's a rare and unique area in relation to bird habitat, basically songbird habitat, a popular destination for birders and those who observe that particular wildlife. So, it's a fairly unique area in that it's not been tilled before. Because it is very alkaline and it's high saline soil, it's not suitable for most ag purposes. That's what makes it a somewhat unique area. And we have run into this in other cases before, and it's something that the commission, I think, is considering with regard to any rules rewrites that we may deal with. Right now, under statute and then implemented by rule, there is very much a preference given towards protecting tillable agricultural land that's previously been tilled. Now, native prairie, which doesn't have the same sorts of protections, and yet you talk to a lot of people in the state and experts in wildlife management, they'll argue, I think, with some validity that the native prairie is actually something that may be more valuable in protecting. The concern that and the reality that I think that they have in pushing that argument too far is everyone knows if there's some sort of development that someone may wish to have take place on their land, and if right now the incentive is for a farmer to just drag a till across that land, and then it's no longer native prairie, which no one's interested in encouraging either. So what we were dealt with in this particular case is the things that are protected, if you will, that receive special recognition that the commission should consider are actual impacts on homes, residences, human beings, tillable agricultural land. All of those things tipped this particular project in favor of going through the alkali flats, basically paralleling that existing line that was there. And that's what tipped it in that.
I think you could say that for this commission, people still prevail over ducks.
Well, but I think it's a broader discussion, though, because this project has a federal nexus, so there's a full NEPA review being done on it. The folks at the federal level that are reviewing this, that is not a designated area in any of these type of rules. So it's this commission's opinion, too, I think, to follow, of course, our rules and guidelines. But even the federal NEPA review, the folks that testified did not have any comments, nor did it come up in any of the other jurisdictions that looked at this, because it's just simply not qualified.
I think it may have been a different answer if you had.
Sure.
If you had game and fish officials, wildlife officials, U.S. Fish and Wildlife come in and say, look, this is an area that needs to be protected. Maybe that would have tipped things a bit the other way, too.
So could we say that the commission did not take it with a grain of salt?
You know, it's funny. The saline characteristics of this land are what make it unique. They're also what make it sort of useless from an agricultural standpoint. But clearly there's always some both wildlife and botanical value to every type of a landscape, but it's really more the uniqueness of it, it seemed to me, than what it produces that makes it somewhat special.
I mean, Kevin's right. That's exactly what made it likely to have a line corridor put through it, is that on the whole, there aren't many residences there. There aren't homes. There aren't people living there. It's not used for agricultural purposes.
Where is this land?
Tailor-made to site projects.
Southwest of Grand Forks.
Yeah, just southwest. South, right near the airport, actually. If you go south of the airport.
There's actually part of this.
And there's the existing power line runs through there.
Correct.
That's right. There's a WAPA line that runs diagonally southwest to northeast through there, and they're going to parallel it, which will minimize the footprint impact, which I think is noble and admirable. And for the most part, that isn't done because you want to sort of create redundancy in the grid, not necessarily compaction, but in this case, I think that accommodation was appropriate and I think appreciated. And I have to also say that the folks from Audubon and Grand Forks Prairie Partners were very respectful. They were very thoughtful. They were very helpful, really, in our deliberation, and their offer of help to the company in terms of further mitigating or at least minimizing negative impact is appropriate, and I hope that it's appreciated by the company and utilized.
Kevin's point was a good one, which is there was a trade-off here with regard to reliability, which
right.
was taken into consideration. It's a slightly less reliable line because it's paralleling an existing line, but it does help mitigate the environmental impacts. So as with anything we do, there's a bit of a trade-off, but I think it's an acceptable trade-off. When I say there's a reliability trade-off, as Kevin suggested, oftentimes in planning grids, you try to create greater separation between two lines so that if a windstorm comes through, it doesn't knock down two major lines at once. In this case, however, doing that would have increased the environmental impacts. Everything the commission does in siting a line is accepting certain trade-offs from a pristine environment. But in this case, I think it was an appropriate way to handle it.
Where were the hearings? Can you refresh my memory?
Yeah, they were Northwood, Carrington, and Washburn.
And, excuse me, the landowners who turned up, what did they say?
No, it ran the gamut. There were certain things that were said which we are outside of the scope of what this commission can deal with. Some landowners brought concerns in relation to compensation packages that they were being offered by the company, kind of general easement concerns, sort of landowner contract type issues, eminent domain, all of those things which are not under the purview of this commission. And while we appreciate hearing those things because we're interested in how that law works, it's not something that we can deal with as part of the siting process. The concerns that were particularly helpful and that we were able to take into consideration and make some changes with regard to were those that were brought up in relation to, as I said before, it might be a farmer who is all right with having a line cross his or her land, but would like it on a little different portion of their property because as they utilize the land itself, it would be better maybe on the north side of the section as opposed to the south side of the section, for example. It might be visual impact where if it was moved a quarter mile away, it would be better for the home's property value. Things like that are changes that are easily enough made, don't stop the project, but allow us to get the kind of input that we need to make a good decision.
Do you remember the cost of that project to build that line?
Yes, it was.
$300 million.
That sounds. That's. I think that's a number we've always sort of generally used, but there's probably a more specific number.
Their application said 310 to 350 or something.
It's in here somewhere.
Sound right, Molly?
We'll be able to find it soon enough.
One of the things that I thought was interesting in all three of the hearings was the methodology they used. Initially, they had three corridors, and they walked us through how they got down to the one corridor, the methodology that they used. I thought that was very helpful. And when I think those in the audience got to hear the company's methodology, I think that, I won't say reduced some of the questions, but it did help a little bit. I think that a lot of things that came up the first day of the hearings, we had folks come back the third day and provide additional information. So it was almost like a back and forth all three hearings.
That was a helpful discussion to have. For example, you'd have some landowners testified and said, why can't you just run it right down Highway 200?
Right.
Highway 200, you know, runs basically the length of the state, and you could put it right in that right away. And that was actually one of the analyzed corridors. The problem is Highway 200 is a much more populated corridor than the one that was ultimately selected, and so what you have is, again, increasing impacts on more people. And that's one of the things that the commission takes into consideration. It made it much more difficult to site it through that area, which is why they chose this line, which is a little comfort to those folks who perhaps don't want it and live on the line in the more northerly route. But, again, we're always comparing and contrasting and taking trade-offs as we site.
Did you get any concerns from folks who say who believe that having a high voltage power line near them is unhelpful?
Yes.
Well, yes, there wasn't. No. I wouldn't call it an overwhelming amount of testimony on that. I think any time that we deal with transmission issues, it's frequent that will be raised as a concern. As I said, there was not a lot of testimony with regard to that from landowner concerns, and the company did do a pretty good job of keeping this away from occupied residences. I mean, there's very few instances where we're hitting that 500-foot corridor, which when you think about a line that's hundreds of miles long, to be able to do that's a pretty good feat. The company did, however, provide expert witness on EMF-type issues, as well as issues related to transmission line impacts on GPS technology, which was a potential concern that was brought up. So the company did a very good job of covering its bases on some of these issues that may come up in transmission.
I was thinking about livestock as well.
That was the main one. Yeah. There was one rancher that raised a concern about the impact on his livestock, his breeding stock, and not opposed to the project per se, but clearly wanted some answers and had some thoughts.
Oh, but the total project cost is $312 million.
Can you just refresh my memory about the relationship between this and the existing line that's being transferred to Ali, or has it been transferred to Ali?
Well, I think legally it's been transferred, although it's still in use somehow with Milton R. Young. Basically, here's the transition. There is an existing DC line, a long DC line, that runs from Center, North Dakota, to Duluth, Minnesota, basically. DC is a little different than AC. It's effectively disconnected from the grid. It just takes power from one point and drops it off at another point, which makes it a little bit of a unique line. It's not typically the way power is transmitted across the country, although DC has a lot of advantages for long-haul technology.
Edison's Revenge, huh?
What's that?
Never mind.
Edison Westinghouse?
Edison's Revenge is what I was
saying. Right. In this case, Minnesota Power, which was one of the companies that had an interest in Milton R. Young Station, was under a requirement in Minnesota to develop more renewables and have less fossil fuel-based generation. And so the other company involved in the Milton R. Young plant, which is Minn-Kota, based out of Grand Forks, were able to strike a deal where Minn-Kota needed more power from the existing fossil fuel station, the coal station. And so they're taking sole ownership of that. And then they'll take the power from Milton R. Young and over this proposed new line, the 345 line, will take it from Center and dump it into Grand Forks, which is basically at the center of their service territory. And then Minnesota Power is using the existing DC line and converting that to almost an entirely wind-only line. And so they're building wind turbines, and one of them, you'll see we have an upcoming hearing, in Center. They're building a series of wind farms in that Oliver Morton County area and transmitting the wind power into northern Minnesota, into Duluth. So in a sense, while this line connects a coal plant to the Minn-Kota system, it really facilitates a lot of wind energy and renewable energy being developed in North Dakota.
The thing I am curious to see as it plays out is, you know, even after Bison 3 is built, you're talking about roughly 300 megawatts of wind capacity, installed capacity, on a line, a DC line that will carry, you know, at least 200, 250 or more additional megawatts of electricity. So there either has to be plans for a lot more wind, or the other question is what backs up that wind when it's not blowing, because that is a major sunk investment in a really big piece of infrastructure that that shouldn't be wasted. So all that remains to be seen.
There was one more piece, too, if I could throw out there, that when they went through the different potential corridors, by moving this to the north, it really shored up reliability in the northern part of the state. That really came out very clear that we've got most of our major transmission lines run south and east, so this really is going to help out that grid to the north.
Yeah, that's actually a great point. I mean, the load differential is not great between north and south. There's a larger load in the southern portion of the territory, but the line differential is quite significant. There are many, many more lines running into the southern end of Minn Kota's service territory as opposed to the northern end of it, and from a reliability standpoint, that's critical, actually.
And of course, with the proposed CapEx line, that only shores up the reliability in the southern part of the valley that much more.
I was looking at the admin. Is there going to be I see that it's been withdrawn, that the request for a hearing in Fargo on South Arc coal mining.
Oh, the reason that was withdrawn is it was a request. It's at it's in front. We have a substantive ALJ, and in these reclamation hearings, that's how it's supposed to go. It goes through the ALJ process first and then to the commission, rather than sort of influence an independent ALJ's decision one way or another. I think we're just going to leave it up to Al Hoberg as the ALJ, and he can make the call on whether to hold that or not.
Okay, so Al Hoberg will decide whether to have a hearing in Fargo.
He's right.
And that's why this is withdrawn, as he decided to
send it back to him. Initially, there was a request that we discuss it and
it's his decision,
and consider what we'd like to do, or even give advice. And it's not that we aren't able to do that, but it would seem peculiar to, in advance of, while a case is still being heard, so to speak, in advance, to give that advice to an independent law judge whose independence is exactly what's most important here. So at any rate, he's heard the case to this point, and will continue the informals once all of the deficiencies that the company is facing are met. They'll continue that informal.
At a certain point, it'll come to the commission, and at that point,
we'll decide.
Make decisions independently.
Just to put it crudely, I mean, does he have a blank check to do stuff? I mean, if he wanted to have hearings all over the place, could he do that?
Well,
no, I guess I don't know. The way that the law is set up is quite clear, which is that there is this division of separation between the commission, who hears the ALJ's decision, and the ALJ, who hears the initial hearings. And so there is that division of labor, and we'll let him make the call on the front end. And I suspect that whatever his decision will be, we'll probably be hearing it on the back end.
The law is also clear, Dale, about requests for informals and the deadlines, the dates. You know, we went through all that when we initially noticed this case. So what's being requested would certainly be an exception to the rule.
I have one quick question about the item TC5, about this 88 megawatt turbine at is it Heskett?
Right.
Is that a replacement or an addition?
No, it would be a new turbine. The MDU has proposed building an 88 megawatt combustion turbine, which would be natural gas fired. If it does go through, they'll need to build a pipeline to connect that station to the source. And it's in response, in part, to the failure of Big Stone 2. MDU still needs additional resources, and that was well established during the Big Stone 2 case. So they'll be needing to bring things online, and like many utilities across the country, the next best option after they weren't able to move forward with Big Stone was some sort of combination of wind and gas, and that's what they're proposing, and that's what we'll be hearing. I should say they're asserting the next best option is, and we'll make that determination.
And of course, this is interesting on a couple of fronts. First of all, there is an application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity, which is, of course, required by any of the investor-owned utilities that we have regulatory authority over before they would build something like this in the state. The second thing is the application for an advanced determination of prudence, and remembering that our law gives a rebuttable presumption of prudence to the company, and so it would be, the burden would be on the advocates in the case to prove otherwise if they choose to go that route. And I don't think any of us is surprised that there's some interest in natural gas turbines. I mean, it is an abundant supply as long as fracking stays safe and allowable. But it's also historically a very volatile fuel. So it's an interesting. I think it's going to be a really kind of an interesting economic case to hear.
They have any particular timeline when they want to start building that?
No, I don't. We've received a letter of intent. We haven't received an application yet. But I can't. The letter of intent probably specifies when they plan. But I'm
in their IRP. It was
Chris. Do you remember 13, 14. Jerry?
That's fairly soon. Yeah.
Is there? I mean, you determined that it was the best option for them, or as a prudent option for them, to build a coal plant. They decided to dump that. I mean, obviously I'm compressing events here,
right,
but they decided to dump that. Now they say, okay, now this is prudent. I mean, does one influence the other?
Well, first they said that a couple wind farms were prudent, don't forget.
Yes.
Well,
does one influence the other is what I mean, can you say, well, gee, you know, you first you wanted this, then it was this. And
recall an MDU's case, the reason that they withdrew from Big Stone 2 isn't because they didn't believe that it was continue to be a prudent project. It was because other partners had dropped out of it, and so there was not the scale at that point to be able to participate in a project. The key to Big Stone 2 was that you had to have a lot of partners building a fairly large plant, which made the economics work, and now with that not as an option, they pulled back. So I
suspect there'll be a lot of questions just like you brought up, Dale.
And no doubt, depending again how aggressive the advocates get, and I don't know their position, but if they at least want to explore it fairly aggressively, no doubt previous testimony and previous cases will be brought up.
Any other questions? Going once, twice. All right. We will reconvene at, let's say, 11:05 for the administrative portion of the agenda. Thank you.